The following program may contain explicit language. It's Friday, August 14th, 2020. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Mike Pence laid down some vice president on vice presidential nominee smack today, or maybe it was snack.
Senator Kamala Harris said she would change the dietary guidelines of this country to reduce the amount of red meat Americans can eat.
The audience there mooing like cows to make clear where red meat comes from. But let's attend to the roasting Mike Pence is about to oversee.
Well, I've got some red meat for you. We're not going to let Joe Biden and Kamala Harris cut America's meat.
Mike Pence working his meat overtime for that killer meat burn. We're not going to let them cut America's meat. America shall continue to swallow its meat whole and like it. Of course, Kamala Harris, not Kamala, by the way, knows that revenge, like potato salad, is a dish best served cold. So don't be surprised if she fillets Meaty Mike in the days to come. If you're worried about one party affecting your meat consumption, I'd look at the one who refused to extend benefits, which would allow American families actually to afford meat. The Trump administration is bragging about bringing back incandescent light bulbs, but they won't give you any assistance to actually pay your electric bills. They'll say, bring back better dishwashers, but good luck on being able to afford an appliance. Instead of President Trump worrying about the amount of water coming out of a shower head, maybe we should all be a little worried about whatever it is leaking out of his head. Seriously, though, and I earnestly believe this, we have close to 170,000 people dead from a very real pandemic. And these guys are running an electoral campaign based on the other side's imaginary plans to curtail future meat consumption. Don't worry, they say. I'm here for what you need as an American, a wetter shower and an older light bulb. My God, the inanity, it's just sad. Sadder still is that it's not rare and almost never well done. On the show today, I spiel about the likely representative from Georgia who, as of now, hasn't voiced a belief in the lizard people, but then again, we haven't found all of her old social media postings. But first, actor Kyle MacLachlan was plucked from near obscurity to star in Dune, which started a lifelong collaboration with director David Lynch. MacLachlan has the jawline of a leading man, but there's something going on inside the eyes, which gives you a little pause. In the new film, Tesla, he stars as Nikola Tesla's rival, Thomas Edison. It's one of the couple of historic roles he's taken on lately. An interesting talk with Kyle MacLachlan up next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Tesla is a new movie by the director Michael Almereyda. Interestingly, Almereyda has been working on this since 1981. And I would think in those almost 30 years since, the popular perception of Tesla has changed enormously, Tesla the man. So now the biopic starring Ethan Hawke probably has a different resonance than it did, I don't know, before the turn of the century when he was an obscure name or just the name of a hair rock band. One of the stars of this movie is Kyle MacLachlan, who plays Thomas Alva Edison. And Kyle joins me now. Thank you. Thanks for coming on, Kyle.
I'm so happy to be here, Mike. Thank you for having me.
So I have to say that I love Thomas Alva Edison. And I think there has been a little bit of a backlash to him for, you know, reasons. I don't know. He did electrocute that elephant one time. But there was a time for a large part of the latter half, the middle and latter half of the 20th century, when he was widely regarded as one of the greatest Americans. And I don't think he's been canceled or anything, but I think that kind of has faded. And I was wondering if coming into this project, you had any perceptions or conceptions of the man and his place in the American imagination.
You know, I too had heard that. I knew what you're speaking, that there was a kind of a, maybe a bit of a backlash against him. And thankfully, our director, Michael Almereyda, wasn't interested in a good and an evil, in a way, making Edison the villain of the piece. I mean, everyone in the film, pretty well-rounded, I think, in terms of characters. You know, there's the things that we, the noble side of everyone, and then there's a side that's not, you know. And I think in Edison's case, you know, you mentioned the electrocution, and these were experiments at the time. They were trying to figure out what this whole electricity thing was, and if there was any competition, really, it was the alternating current versus the direct current. Direct current, of course, represented by Thomas Edison, and alternating current by Nikola Tesla, you know. And so that was kind of where they set up the playing field. But I was happy that Michael wasn't interested in that, and it was more about let's learn a little bit about each of these men and kind of how they bumped around into each other in this, you know, in a transformative period of time in American history, or in world history, actually, with the creation of this new electricity.
So it must be pretty satisfying as an actor to play a character like that, where there is a lot of nuance as to good and evil, especially when it's a real character, because that's actually how life goes. But on the other hand, I would imagine you also really enjoy inhabiting those David Lynchian worlds where good and evil is really stark. But maybe the difference is when you're doing something that owes some fealty to historical figures versus when you're doing something that's kind of creating a parable or a fictional universe.
Yeah, very true. In David Lynch's universe, there's a strong definition between, or dividing line, I should say, between good and evil. And you know, I was had so much fun in the previous Twin Peaks, being able to actually play both sides of that. I wasn't sure I would actually be able to pull it off, to be honest. But I was very pleased with the result, and with David's help, I think we created something kind of unusual there. One of the great things, I think, as I work through some of the historical figures, and I've also got an 8-part series coming out about where I play FDR, is simply the research. I mean, these people are fascinating, and I, as I've gotten older, I think history becomes, as we all become more historical ourselves, history becomes more interesting and fascinating. Whereas when I was in, you know, junior high school, college, it didn't really hold much allure for me. But the research was really fun to do and to learn about these men and put you know, try to place myself in their head, you know, and trying to figure out what was driving them, what were the motivators, why they did what they did. And that, as an actor, that's one of the benefits, I guess.
So when you play FDR, people obviously have a pretty strong idea of maybe his speaking habits, his mannerisms. And I know he was actually very intent on managing public perception. Still, lot of tape, lot of audio tape. He's a known quantity. So I would guess that you have to be somewhat true. With Edison, there's film of him. You can, if you choose to, ape his mannerisms, but you're not as obliged to. So to what extent do you want to be accurate to the accurate Edison? And to what extent do you feel, okay, I could use that or I could discard that more than you would a very well-known historical character like FDR?
You know, in both cases, I look at their movement through space, the mannerisms, the method of speaking. And again, I'm looking for what are the emotions, the feelings, the thoughts that are being transmitted through that physical action. So how does Edison cup his ear in particular when he can't hear something? You know, he was almost completely deaf. And how does that affect his how he deals with people, how he looks at people, how he feels in a situation? Is he short with people because he just doesn't care? It's too much effort for him to actually hear what they're saying. You know, how does it affect his temperament? You know, his emotions. And that was true both in Edison and in FDR. As you said, FDR was really super aware and conscious of how he was perceived. Never wanted to be crippled. It was okay to be lame. You know, just those little distinctions, and super, super conscious of that. Kind of almost modern, I think, in a strange way. I mean, you think of how people are so, with our social, faces, how we present ourselves to the world, and he was really, really aware of that. Edison, yeah, not so much. Gruff, didn't really care. There's some terrific footage of him moving through space. You know, he was kind of a bull, you know, and he was certainly an inventor, but a lot of it was just perseverance, really, in his case. It's like, if this doesn't work, then try this. And if that doesn't work, then try this. That's the way they finally came up with the filament that they ultimately used in the light bulb. It was just really just over 600 different materials were tried, trial and error. And that's how they move forward. It's just, you know, very plodding, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's how great characters are made, that their strength is also their fatal flaw. And with Edison, it's that he's exactly what you said, like bullheaded and moving through space. So that is what allowed him to come up with these great inventions, but it also was his undoing to some extent with the iron mining, and especially with his adherence that DC current was going to be the way that we got our electricity in the United States.
Yeah, fully believed in it. One of the other challenges about that is okay, so we recognize it. That's pretty obvious about that side of his nature. What's the opposite? Does it exist? How does it exist? So that's always, as part of the actor's journey, I'm always looking for that as well. And he did indeed wrote during a summer a diary when he was staying with some friends. And I read through that, and it was full of flights of fancy and sort of romanticizing and really strong insights into people and humor and very self-deprecating. I mean, it was like a side of him that we don't know about unless you've read this little book of his diary. And I found that fascinating. And I thought, okay, so we want to lay a little bit of that in here somewhere. And, you know, in fact, Michael really helped me by creating a couple of the scenes. I don't know how much I want to talk about them, but there were scenes in there that the narrator then comes in and sort of, you know, sets the record straight. You know, Eve Hewson, of course, plays Anne Morgan, and she sort of narrates the whole thing. And so she sort of says, well, you know, so we play with the idea of these flights of fancy that as part of Edison's nature. But I do believe it was there. Maybe not, you know, out something he showed to the world that much, but it did exist.
Right. So, and we should tell the listeners, I don't think it's giving too much away. It seems like a straight kind of biopic, a historical biopic. Everyone's wearing the fashion of the day. But then there are these flourishes, let's say, a little bit of naughtiness and playing with the form, purposeful anachronisms, some maybe false narration. You get, in fact, to, again, I don't want to step too much on it, but you get to play a scene that's more of a what-if scene. Is that any different from an acting perspective, playing a scene that you know is going to quickly be undercut as that didn't happen? Do you play it a little less honestly than you would the scene in a regular narration?
Not at all. No winking at the audience. It was absolutely dead as if it had happened. You know, it's like, what if this had happened? And we sort of play it straight through. And then, so you let the discovery, the audience discover something. Hopefully we fool them, you know, for a good length of time until finally it pushes the point of reality where you're like, okay, when he pulls, you know, when Edison does, you know, he interacts with a device that's obviously not from the era, and you're like, okay, you know, and you realize, okay, but it also connects the dots a little bit. So again, it's part of Michael Almereyda's brain. You know, he just came up with these sort of interesting twists and turns, and which is what makes it working with him so interesting. You know, his storytelling is very special.
with 10 minutes left in the movie, and we've established it plays with narrative. It's not a straightforward biopic, but it does operate that way. There is a, let us say, a big break with convention that I won't give away. You're not in that scene, but you know, you read the script, you want to be in the movie. Does that mean that like you're signing off on that and saying, okay, I think this is going to work? Or is it like, hey, you've worked with David Lynch so long, let's not doubt perhaps even the very, eccentric taste of a director that you have faith in? What's your reaction to that choice?
To be honest, I don't remember reading it in the original script. I don't remember reading that scene. I'm now questioning whether it was there or if maybe it was something that sort of came up. You know, the movie, you know, the film is, it's in, I know there's independent, but this is independent with a capital I. I mean, we had no money. You know, it was the fact that we had costumes that looked, I mean, it was, people did amazing work. And, you know, I mean, our dressing rooms were basically just curtained off with a cot. You know, I mean, that was it, kind of on the set where we were shooting. I mean, this was, you know, really low budget. And I remember watching it for the first time, and then suddenly there was Ethan, and I'm doing, you know, we were talking about, I don't want to give it away. And I was like, whoa, I said, that's, wow, what a interesting choice. You know, I was like, am I with this or am I not? But I had sort of a similar reaction to it. And then after I sort of sat with it for a while, I was like, no, I think it's okay. Why not? You know, I mean, we're talking about the same themes in some ways. And, you know, whether the movie jumps the shark at that moment, I mean, I think it's open to interpretation. but I kind of went with it, to be honest.
Let me ask you about a couple other roles. Are you excited that they're doing a remake of Dune?
I am. I'm looking forward to it. I mean, I don't know if excited is the word, but I'm really looking forward. I love the books. I've loved the books since I was 15, and I read them for the first time, and I read them like almost yearly until, and then I was cast when I was 23. So it was a little strange. I mean, I don't think my story is one of a kind. You know, many people love the books, particularly at that age. But the fact that I was just I was a Dune fanatic, and then here you are doing it, but it's a challenging piece. I mean, my God, you know, we tried to do it in a movie. It was 2 hours and 16 minutes, and you know, it's all over the place. I mean, I think it's visually stunning. I think it's interesting. You know, it doesn't necessarily succeed in telling the story or capturing. It captures, you know, some of the environment, but it's just so vast. So I'm very curious to see what Villeneuve's take on it is. I'm sure there'll be, you know, there's many things that have to be just cut and just discarded, sadly, because there's just not enough time. I always thought that it would be a fantastic, kind of in the way of the Game of Thrones. You know, you have these seasons, you know, you have 10 shows or something like that, but you actually break it down and you tell the whole thing, but you do it, you know, at that scale, you know, and...
Because the political machinations are really interesting, and
oh,
you can
gosh.
Only touch on them a bit in the, you know, the movie has to, most of the attention has to be riding sandworms.
Yeah, you want the action and the adventure, and who are these Fremen people, and where do they live in the desert, and what's going on? But I mean, there's so much. So I just love the world. I love the books. I'm curious to see what they can do. I'm curious to see with you know, because this, I mean, we did ours in 83, shot in 83, and of course the technology was primitive compared to what we have today. So
yeah, I mean, did you have to wear blue contact lenses? Would they have done that in post-production today?
No, you know, we tried that. I was the guinea pig on a lot of those, as was Rafaela. We put them in and they, you know, because I wore contacts and I was like, nope, you know, no way. And it was really, again, the sophistication wasn't there to do that, but really it was more trying to do, they had a rotoscope everything because it's the blue within blue. So it's the white of your eyes is actually blue and there's just no way to sort of, I mean, now you can do it. You could wrap the eye, but then you're, you know, you're fighting all the dust and the sand and you know,
it's not acting, it's just, you know, struggling at that point.
Struggling, yeah, exactly right. And which, and we did a fair amount of that, just shooting outdoors in deserts in these rubber suits and so on. But gosh, what a great novel, and what a, you know, so I'm looking forward to it very much.
Another role I want to ask you about, Showgirls. Okay, maybe not your favorite role in retrospect, but I heard an interview you give where you said at the time it seemed pretty good. Do you think that could have been a very different movie if it was, I don't know, edited a different way or conceived of differently given the raw material?
I don't know. I don't know how. I mean, you read it and you go, wow, this is, you know, it's pretty dark and it's very, you know, it's there's a, just a lot of, you know, bad behavior, you know, going on. And at the time I was, you know, I said, well, God, I love Paul Verhoeven. I, you know, RoboCop, I loved it. You know what I mean? Basic Instinct, I loved, you know, and Joe Esterhaus had written a screenplay and, you know, at the top of his game. And so you're kind of like, all right, well, I'm gonna throw in with these guys, you know. I mean, this looks kind of interesting. Gina Gershon, I knew and still friendly with Gina, and I was like, all right, you know. And to be honest, it was at a period of time in my career when, you know, I've been playing certain kind of roles, and you know, you're starting to feel a little kind of hemmed in. You're like, I'm gonna try something completely different, and you, you know, I may have cast the net a little bit wide on the, you know, in that one, but it was something that. You know, it was a gamble, obviously, you know, and crazy thing is, you know, we were shooting in South Lake Tahoe, I think that's where we were for a lot of it. I remember we were in a giant, you know, theater that they had there, and we had to get out by a certain time because Carrot Top was going to be coming in to perform. He had to start, and we had a done by date we had to finish up with.
I mean, the load time for that guy's props must have been massive.
Yeah. Oh God. I mean, it was great. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm wandering around. I'm watching them choreograph the show. They've got, you know, really solid choreographers from Los Angeles, and they're putting together this whole Vegas show. And I'm looking at it from the audience. I'm going, geez, this looks pretty good. The volcano shooting fire and, you know, scantily clad women and men running around. I said, yeah, this looks like a show. This is what it would be, you know? And you think, okay. And meanwhile, you know, when I wasn't working, I was also sneaking off to ski because that winter, you know, and all around Tahoe, snow was fantastic. So I was kind of half paying attention, half not paying attention until I saw it for the first time. And then I was, oh boy.
Kyle MacLachlan could be driving down the FDR Drive, take a right, go to the Con Ed building and know that he's played two of the roles of the proper nouns in that sentence. Quite an amazing accomplishment. Thank you so much, Kyle.
What a pleasure, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
And now the spiel. You probably have heard of Marjorie Taylor Greene. It looks like West Georgia, Northwest Georgia, will have as its U.S. member of Congress a woman who runs the full alphabet of nuttiness. QAnon, NRA, AR-15s, oh, and a little MS-13.
MS-13 was basically like, they were the kind of the henchmen of the Obama administration. They did a lot of the dirty work. Seth Rich was murdered by two MS-13 gang members. That's what I mean by dirty work.
You're a fool to do that dirty work, or believe it. But Marjorie Greene has a lot of fools in her district. I base that on the fact that they voted for a woman who says stuff like this.
We had witnessed 9/11, the terrorist attack in New York, and the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania, and the so-called plane that crashed into the Pentagon. It's odd. There's never any evidence shown for a plane in the Pentagon. But anyways, I'm not going to dive into the 9/11 conspiracy.
Yeah, kind of did. Enough to prove the unstated thesis. Your insuitability to the corridors of power. Though there are institutions I could think of that would warrant Greene's inclusion. They're governmental, minus the govern. But voters of Georgia's 16th beg to differ, leaving the rest of us simply begging. By a margin of 43,000 to 32,000, Greene beat her primary challenger, John Cowan. Now, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to see the racism all over the claims that she's making. When she's not blathering on homemade videos, she's actually spending money on ads that say things like this.
The Antifa mobs and BLM thugs want to erase our history and tear down our monuments.
Like I said, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to see Marjorie Greene for what she is. But as luck would have it, John Cowan is a brain surgeon. The voters decided he is not qualified enough to rebut a raving loon. Perhaps Greene had a more sophisticated message than I'd realized. I don't know. To the non-racists, she offers conspiracy theories. To the members of the electorate who don't care about 9/11 fanfic and Seth Rich alternative histories, she just lays out what's wrong with the other races.
But the generations of Black and Hispanic men, do you want to know what holds them down? Gangs.
Games? What are you talking, hopscotch? Pokemon? Huh?
Gangs. Being in gangs and dealing drugs.
Oh, gangs.
Being in gangs and dealing drugs is what holds them down. The lack of education is what holds them down. That's not a white person thing.
I can name one white person who doesn't seem that educated.
They tell the young men in their communities, don't go to school. Don't you move out of this project. Don't you move out of this community. You join this gang.
Yes, that is why they don't move out of the projects. Lots of people having to make that tough choice between a 3-bedroom condo with amenities, you know, not a full eaten kitchen, but a breakfast nook. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, gangs. Yeah, I do remember season 2 of The Wire. Bodie was like, well, Owings Mills, fine school district, but property taxes. I shall commit myself to this gang. Though, to be fair, in The Wire, they did say this.
Shit, some things just stay the same, man. I mean, the game is the game.
So maybe it was games. Who knows? Let's hear out the final thoughts on this issue. Future member of Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
The gangs are holding them back. It's not white people. It's crazy.
Fact check. Yes, I have detected some craziness. And the crazy thing about her particular flavor of crazy is not the crazy stuff. It's the ignorant, wrong, and racist stuff. But in case you wanted it, there is plenty of cuckoo bananas business, i.e. Q, Anon.
Now, there's a couple of things that happened. One of them was when Q signs off, he puts three little crosses in a row, three little crosses. And that's how he signed off. Now, he signed off with three crosses in a row on November 6th. And within a matter of minutes, President Trump, in his tweet right after that on November 6th, he put, it was 7 minutes later, Trump put three little crosses on his tweet. And it was just more than a coincidence. It was really interesting.
Three crosses, tres X's, and a four-alarm fire of gaga. QAnon, COVID, conspiracies, some thoughts on the Las Vegas shooter, which she suggested was orchestrated not by a shooter, but powerful forces beyond the abilities of just one man.
How do you get avid gun owners and people that support the Second Amendment to give up their guns and go along with anti-gun legislation? How do you do that? Maybe you accomplish that by performing a mass shooting into a crowd that is very likely to be conservative, very likely to vote Republican.
I know you get it. She has expressed multiple theories that are unhinged and you would hope disqualifying. I do think there's some value in playing them all in one place, so you get the idea that this isn't just one misstatement or one mistake or one month where she fell in with the wrong crowd. It is consistent that she is a florid conspiracist par excellence. And still, no more than 32,000 West Georgians had a problem with that. That was Dr. John Cowan's vote. Green, as I said, got 43,000. Now, there are 700,000 people, give or take, per every congressional district. So 43,000 out of 700,000, it's about 6% of the population. It's not shockingly low or exceedingly low for a primary in American politics, but it is low. It is just, objectively speaking, a small number of people to give such a powerful decision to allow them to elect such a demonstrably unqualified, and I'm going to say unwell person, to ascend to a major position. I mean, 100,000 more voters voted in Ilhan Omar's primary than Marjorie Greene's. Yet both women will almost certainly be colleagues in the 117th Congress. Today, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution asked, who's crazy, Marjorie Taylor Greene or her Georgia voters? I'll throw another party in there, the system. These spots in government are too important to allow 6% of the people to decide for the rest of us. I don't know if somewhere out there, there is a more functional version of true democracy that would necessarily do the work of weeding out the wingnuts. I mean, yeah, there are a lot of odd ducks among us. But I've got to think that it's hard to find a random or even non-random, a geographically based grouping of almost a million Americans where the majority are pleased to send to Washington a person with the obsessions and concerns of Marjorie Greene, especially at this time. Because right now, in this moment, we should be focusing on getting the bat flu contained, not elevating the batshit insane. And that's it for today's show. Daniel Schrader produces The Gist, reminiscent of Kyle MacLachlan in Blue Velvet. He has a good ear, I found. Margaret Kelly is The Gist's other producer. I have to tell you, her transcriptions of long interviews, they're invaluable, but sometimes inscrutable. She is the mysterious log lady. Alicia Montgomery, executive producer of Slate Podcast, her people crafted barrels that were suited for long valleys. A Dale Cooper, if you will. The Gist. Fun fact, David Bowie played Tesla in the movie The Prestige, and David Bowie also played FBI agent Philip Jeffries in Twin Peaks, opposite Kyle MacLachlan. Of course, Bowie's voice was dubbed when he was depicted as a glowing orb near a tea kettle in Twin Peaks The Return, but I fear I have already said too much. Oom-pru-de-pru-du-pru, and thanks for listening.